Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, Asus PQ321Q. We want 4K desktop monitors now. Summer cooling for your router, more memory, Maxis SSD life, power supply secrets, AMD's losing less, and a little sneak preview of Intel's next CPU. All this and more, it's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 226, recorded on July 18th, 2013. Router cooling.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code Twitch.
Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm your host, Patrick Norton, and this is the show on Twit where we try to bring you the most useful, most informative, and helpful news in the PC and tablet universe. Joining me today, as almost always, Mr. Ryan Shroud of PCPer.com. Dude, are you excited about the Asus PQ321Q 4K monitor you got your grubby little hands on last week?
You said that model number differently than any other person I'd ever heard
PQ say that model number. PQ321Q.
There you go. PQ321, I had never heard. It is a very good monitor, actually. I got it in on Friday, and we've been playing with it since.
Have you been gaming on it? Because it seems like the biggest challenge for 4K monitors right now is that, hey, 4K is running at 30 hertz, at least until next year, over HDMI, which has been a little painful for some of the people using 4K monitors for gaming. Sir, did you enjoy 4K gaming at 30 hertz?
Well, this is not 30 hertz. So the kind of the big change on this display, the previous 4K monitor that it was a TV that I tested gaming on was the Seiki 50-inch LCD TV. It was a 4K display. And it was single HDMI input, and it was 3840 by 2160 at 30 hertz. This display is one of the, I think there's a Sharp model out there that is basically built on the same platform. And it is supports two HDMI inputs, kind of, or what's more interesting and kind of better is it supports DisplayPort 1.2 MST, which stands for multi-stream transport. And a multi-stream transport connectivity means that it actually is able to, when you hook this up to a graphics card, it kind of appears as two monitors. And there's actually two heads in the display, left side, right side. And so what you'll notice while you're using this monitor is that it's technically two displays in one housing. There's a left side and a right side, and you can actually use them independently. But the cool thing that you can do now is you essentially are running, so you're running two displays at 1920. Yeah, you can see it there. 1920 by 2160 at 60 hertz, right? So you're running half of the screen powered from each stream at 60 hertz. And so MST enables this over a single cable. It makes it easier that way. And in theory, once the new VESA 1.3 standard is kind of implemented in the firmware and with these drivers, it also makes configuration a lot easier because the MST transport will say, hey, I am two displays. This is the left and this is the right. And configure yourself accordingly. And the driver will be able to handle all that and do it automatically. As it stands today, like if you hook this up to an AMD 7970, it shows up as two monitors, and then you actually run the AMD iFinity configuration tool in the driver, and you say, yep, okay, I've got two displays. Let's run them in portrait mode, side by side. And yes, this one's my left, and this one's my right, and it does like kind of the standard configuration options there. Go ahead.
Two questions. One, can you do it with NVIDIA? And two, is it just me or do I keep hearing the voice in my head keeps going, nice hack, nice hack, nice hack.
So let me address the first part about NVIDIA initially. When I did this live stream on Friday of kind of like, we've got the box, let's open it up, show what we get, and then hook it up and see what happens. When we hooked it up to the AMD setup, it was a very smooth, painless process. It just worked. It showed up two displays. We did the Affinity configuration, and boom, we were off and running. With NVIDIA, it was not as pretty. It wasn't as nice of an experience. There is an issue with the NVIDIA graphics cards and DisplayPort MST that keeps it from occasionally actually booting all the way up in a cold boot scenario. So if the system's completely off when you hit the power button, you know, I was seeing on our post tag on our ASUS motherboard that it was stopping at like 6.2 when it's supposed to go up to AA. I never looked up what 6.2 was, but I knew that this was something that NVIDIA was aware of. You hit reset and it would boot up into Windows and then, you know, it would work. Mm-hmm. The second part is GeForce does not support surround configurations. They're multi-monitor, multi-display configurations with two monitors. They've only ever supported three monitors. And so they kind of had to release a special driver. Actually, it just came out publicly today, and they sent it to me a few days earlier, last week when I told them I was having this monitor in, to actually run kind of a pseudo surround 2x1. What's nicer, it sucks that, you know, NVIDIA's kind of having to add this in because of these monitors being released. It kind of shows a lack of foresight on their part. But what is
interesting... they were developing really bizarre handheld gaming devices to propel the future of gaming device handheld gadgets that nobody uses.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah,
but
you're right.
But the benefit to their implementation is now, once it works, you don't actually have to set anything up. Like, their driver recognizes the display and it says it doesn't show up as two monitors. You don't have to do any additional setup steps. And that's how, once the new VESA 1.3 standard is actually implemented, probably later this year, and the monitor, that's ideally what you want, right? Because if you're a consumer that buys a tiled display, a tiled monitor, that's what these are called. You know, you don't necessarily want to, you don't care that there's two heads in there, or maybe they make a monitor that has four heads. You don't really want the consumer worried about that and having to think about that. Just plug it in, the graphics card and the monitor, figure it out. And NVIDIA's kind of implemented that pre-VESA 1.3 implementation just to kind of prove that it's there. So it does work. It works well. And when you can now, once you get all the setup done, you can run 3840 by 2160 at 60 hertz, which is a noticeable improvement experience wise over what we had with our 30 hertz testing, for sure. Not just in gaming, but in like desktop usage.
So we should point out the ASUS monitor we're talking about right now is a 4K monitor, and it is a 31.5-inch monitor, which essentially means, well, yeah, you could use it as a television, but we're thinking of it primarily as a desktop monitor. What did you think of actually computing on in terms of day-to-day computing tasks, you know, running Windows, doing documents, browsing the website? Because all I can think of is like, man, you know, I loved the idea of a 4K monitor, but the 30 hertz refresh rate was kind of killing me. For videos, it was great. For desktop computing, it was a bit much. But this sounds like it must be absolutely fantastic.
It is really great. And we posted a video on our website. And it's really, you know, it's impossible to show you in a 720p or a 1080p video what it's like to compute on a 4K display.
Right.
You know, what's interesting is when the MacBook Pro with the Retina screen came out, the 2880 by 1800 resolution screen, it was an extraordinary jump forward. But what Apple did was they said, we're going to scale things a little bit differently so that you don't have really tiny icons and the interface things that you actually click on and touch and scroll through aren't like super tiny, like too tiny that you can't see. By default with Windows 8, that's what you get. The new Windows 8.1 that came out 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I guess, actually added support for kind of automatic configuration of higher DPI monitors.
Interesting. And
so it's, you know, when you first set this up and you're running 3840 by 2160, you know, your icons are really tiny. And it's kind of cool to see how many browser windows kind of actually show side by side and that kind of stuff. And it was neat to do that. But in actual use case, what I did was I went into the DPI settings for the OS, set it to 150% instead of 100%. It makes everything a little bit bigger, but it still stays sharp. And I think that's the best kind of use case for it. It depends on how close you are to the monitor. If you can handle reading and using a browser at 100% DPI level, kind of the default DPI level for Windows, then you can get a lot of real estate into this 32-inch monitor. But I think for most people, what you're getting is additional real estate, but then much, much better clarity in those pixels while using Windows. But there's all kinds of weird things like Chrome versus Firefox. Chrome does not look very good. It doesn't scale fonts the same way that Firefox and Internet Explorer do. And as a result, the Chrome browser actually looks significantly worse on text when you're in that 150% DPI.
That's a big deal, since most of us spend a lot of time in browsers. We should also point out, in case you didn't catch the show last week, this is a $3,500 monitor right now. This is extremely bleeding edge. You must has all the cash to buy this. This is entry level used car area in terms of it. It's also going to require if you want to do 3D gaming, you're going to need a pretty badass video card to throw at this thing.
Yeah, the gaming thing is going to be a longer term story for us, because lots of things are going to change with this. So when we did the first 4K testing, it's just a single panel, right? Now when we're testing it, we're essentially testing it under surround and Eyefinity configurations, right? So things that weren't a problem before can suddenly become a problem. Mm-hmm. Our testing methodology, trying to capture the output, we cannot capture 3840 by 2160 at 60 hertz MST. We just don't have the capability to do that yet. And there's also the issue of if you have to have a powerful graphic system to run it at 4K, because so far in my testing, there is no way to run the monitor at a lower resolution without rebooting the monitor in single stream mode as opposed to multi-stream mode. And so that's kind of a downer.
Why would you want to do that?
Yeah, well, imagine you're a user that has like a 660 Ti and you're like, well, I want that monitor for desktop purposes for like productivity. And I'm going to upgrade my graphics down the line. So I'm going to prepare for this. So I'll use my, I can use my operating system at 4K resolution, but then when I go to game, I'll just turn it on 1080p and, I'll game like that for 5-6 months or whatever it is till I can afford a Titan or whatever it is. Well, you won't be able to do that without rebooting the monitor. The rebooting process is not like a really easy 2-second thing that has to happen. So there's
if you have $3,500, I would hope. Okay, it's reasonable to just do, using it as a desktop, but it's like, man, if you're going to drop $3,500 on the flat panel on the new monitor, please have $1,000 for a GPU to go along with it.
I would agree with that. I agree, but I was surprised when we posted that we were getting this monitor in. I had two different people say that. Well, let me know how it does on 1080p upscaling, because that's what I plan on running my games at for X amount of time. And I was like, okay, that's a fair enough request. I'll look at what that is. And then
I should also acknowledge, given that today's $1,000 GPUs will be next year's $300 GPUs, it's probably a reasonable thing to want to wait before dropping all the cash on a GPU that you know is going to be worth significantly less in the next year.
Yeah. Yep. Lots to look forward to.
PC Per Live, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't caught it, Ryan in this case got together with Lee. What's Lee's last name?
Garbett.
I'm sorry, my apologies, Lee. Right. If you've ever wondered, we've talked about it on Taxzilla, you've talked about it on PC Per, we've talked about it on Twitch. You need a decent GPU. Well, it would be nice to have a decent GPU, but it's essential to have a decent power supply, a PSU of quality inside of your PC. And since they all kind of look the same from the outside, they're almost always black these days. They have slots in them. You can usually see copper through the slots. And they claim a lot of things that are occasionally completely hokey. But if you've ever wondered what characterizes a good PSU, why PC power supplies are called switchers or switching power supplies, single versus multi-rail output, if you ever wanted to tear open a power supply and have it explain to you what all those little bits and pieces are and why more copper is almost always good. And also, I believe you guys got to talk about power supply testing also.
Yeah, I've done a lot of videos on our site, and I think that this video that we posted, I think anybody that's listening to this should go find this video and watch it, because I believe it has the most information per minute of screen time of anything we've ever posted. I think anybody, even if you know a lot about power supplies, you're going to learn stuff from this video. It was great to have him in studio. So he's been working for PC Perspective and doing power supply reviews for like 10 or 12 years. And we've never really had him in to do videos. And I said, hey, I want to come in and let's talk about what you think makes a good power supply. Answer some of the more common questions people have about power supplies, like what's power factor correction? Do you prefer single rail versus multi-rail? What about completely 100% modular power supplies versus semi-modular versus no module, non-modular power supplies? Let's address a lot of that. Let's talk about how we test things. Let's talk about what the insides of a power supply are. And I learned quite a bit from him about how a switching power supply works, what it even means to be a switching power supply. At the beginning of the show, he actually, I don't know if you'd ever seen, he brought in a linear power supply. Yeah, that right there. so that is a 240-watt power supply, and it weighs, I think, just over 20 pounds.
Right.
And it's a 240-watt, 12-volt power supply. And it's one giant capacitor, one giant coil, and a couple of little components there in between. And it was kind of a joke because of how heavy it was. It was difficult to lift off the table, the angles we were sitting. So it's just
it's like looking
at a
Class A amplifier where it's pretty much at full power all the time. And you will have all the electrical bill.
Yeah, so we don't get down to like which specific power supplies are necessarily the best in this. But we go over what qualities you should look for, what wattage levels you should want, like what, you know, percentage of maximum load you should be looking at for when you're actually picking out a power supply. So a lot of the questions that I know that we get on Twitch are about that kind of stuff. And I thought it was a really good, really, really good event in terms of information that was handed out.
Some fantastic. I mean, just looking at it, having somebody walk you through the inside of a power supply. Explain what's going on is pretty fascinating. Interesting link I got thrown at me. At McClonus tweets, at Patrick Norton, at Lifehacker, there may be no such thing as too much memory in your computer if you have an SSD. And it linked to a Lifehacker summary of a really interesting collection of testing from Tom's Hardware. Quote, adding RAM to your PC may help cut back on writes to your SSD, potentially increasing its lifespan. In fact, their benchmarks reveal up to a 63% reduction with 16 gigabytes of DDR3 memory compared to 4 gigabytes. So, they basically ran some tests. They were looking at the number of writes to an SSD because writes are basically what kind of wear out an SSD over time. And in theory, you should not be able to wear out your SSD with any human amount of use. But they looked at Autodesk 3ds Max 2012, Photoshop CS6, Microsoft Visual Studio 2010, and they saw an average reduction of 45% because you have so much information living in main system memory instead of being written back off to the SSD. The Tom's Hardware is conclusion was, quote, in essence, there is no such thing as too much memory in a desktop with solid state storage. The more RAM you add, the better off endurance looks and the more IO performance you get from the storage subsystem. So, you know, I suddenly feel excited about putting even more RAM in systems that probably don't need more RAM. But now I've got an excuse to add more RAM into my systems with SSDs, which is actually all of them right now, except for my desktop at work. Really interesting.
So the workloads on this test are 3D Studio Max 2012, Photoshop CS6, and Visual Studio 2010. So you're compiling Google Chrome in one, you are photo merging 7 18 megapixel images, and then you're rendering a 1440 by 1080 mental ray image. I guess this isn't that surprising to me because 4 gigs of memory is kind of low for those particular tasks. Right. Would you agree?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thought, right? Because
I'd be curious to see, show me 4 gigs, show me 8 gigs, show me 16 gigs, right? Because from 4 to 16, I think that's a significant increase. And 4 gigs, I would say for anybody who's doing workstation level stuff, is too little. 8 gigs might be just fine. I mean, you're basically talking about how often are you writing page files?
Well, I think what they were looking at is obviously pushing the boundaries on this. I think it would also apply if you're doing video editing to talk about more consumer-friendly stuff. But
Yeah, they were looking at the Extreme. I would also say, based on the number of systems I've looked at recently, there are a shocking number of people that are still running 4 gigabytes of RAM, or think that 4 gigabytes of RAM is all the memory. You know, and technically, while your games might, you know, live quite, most of your older games and a lot of your newer games might live quite comfortably inside of that space and are not going to benefit from the addition of additional RAM from adding more RAM, getting more RAM, putting more RAM in your system. You know, multitasking and dealing with larger files are going to benefit from that. I don't know. I thought it was interesting.
I think it is. I wonder why they did more testing. 16. Just give me that spot in between. It is very clear 4, 8, 16.
Right.
Just give me that middle one. And my guess is that it would have been very close to the 16, but that's just a guess.
Well, you could always replicate the tests in your own spare time when you're not testing 4K monitors and GPUs.
I could.
Or, you know, I don't know. I thought it was worth reading. By the way, if you missed last week's show, the freaking GeForce GTX 770 is freaking awesome. And Haswell is shockingly good. The onboard graphics on Haswell are shockingly good for gaming, which you can find out if you take a look at a MacBook Air, like an 11-inch MacBook Air. I just want to lay that out there. Bunch more news and some viewer questions coming up. But first, we want to take a moment to thank ProXPN.
That is right. ProXPN is a global VPN, virtual private network. For those of you that may not know what that is, it works with almost any internet connection. It creates a secure, encrypted tunnel through which all of your online data passes back and forth. I think it's no surprise why we're getting this particular sponsor at this particular time in history. This is essentially a software that will help anonymize you, your traffic, and what you're doing on the internet, regardless if you're doing anything right or wrong, just that you choose that you want to stay as anonymous as possible. This ProXPN will work with any online application, including web browser, email, file sharing, instant messaging programs. ProXPN keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location, and giving you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. You know, I do travel a lot, and I have to say, when I am out of the country specifically, that's when it's the worst. You know, you're using hotel internet, you're using hotel Wi-Fi. I don't exactly know what's going on at any of these places. It always makes me feel a little bit better to know that whatever I'm doing, whether it's talking to my wife or checking my email or whatever it is, we're not being monitored in any kind of fashion. So ProXPN would be a great solution for anybody that has this. And even if you're not traveling, if you're at home, this is something that, you know, you don't want your ISP to spy on you. You don't want people outside of that to spy on you. You can still use this to take control back over what people are seeing and what they know about you. It has complete online privacy through 512-bit encryption tunnel. It works via OpenVPN or PPTP, your choice. Protect yourself against your ISP's 6 strikes rule. Keep your personal internet usage private at work. Bypass internet filtering and blocked websites. You can also bypass geographical restrictions for internet content and online video with worldwide servers in the US, the UK, Asia, and more. ProXPN makes the internet connection region free, if you will. They have software for Windows and Mac. They offer advanced controls, allowing you to select programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. You don't have to do all or none. ProXPN also works with your iOS or Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy on the go. No app is required. They have world-class customer support. And even Steve Gibson, who you all will know from security shows, Security Now on this network, gave it a great review. So that's pretty high praise, I think, coming for him. Go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year. We've got a special offer, though. If you use code TWICH, T-W-I-C-H, you'll receive 20% off for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up, but use the offer code TWICH, T-W-I-C-H. And we thank ProXPN for their support of this week in computer hardware.
AMD is losing less money. Woo! AMD's Second quarter 2013 earnings, net loss of $74 million, expects a return to profitability next quarter, which we love because we want AMD to continue providing CPUs to help keep Intel keep their prices in check. At least that's our theory, and we're not fighting it. We want somebody to opposing NVIDIA and opposing Intel to try to keep some type of competition in the market. You know, the rough news in Gadget posted was that AMD, quote, saw just $1.16 billion in revenue for its Q2 2013. That's an 18% decrease in revenue year over year. But CEO Rory Reed did say that things are looking up. Their focus on restructuring and transforming AMD resulted in improved financial results. And AMD expects significant revenue growth and return to profitability in the third quarter, which is a way of saying, yo, the consoles from Sony and Microsoft are coming, and we are going to sell a lot of APUs inside of those consoles. Yeah, it's interesting. And the other thing is basically AMD's graphics division is doing pretty good. But it's going to be interesting. Yeah. Also interesting, kind of a curious week for Intel. Tom's Hardware got a hold of a Core i7-4960X Ivy Bridge E sample and benchmarked.
That's apparently
it.
What I read.
Okay. I love that line. Tom's Hardware acquired from somewhere an early engineering sample of the upcoming Core i7-4960X. Scott wrote it up for PCPer.com. quote, Intel was allegedly not involved with this preview, and thus I would expect we're not the supplier for the review unit. It's interesting. Gives you a general ballpark of E performance. And if I'm looking at I'm reading the benchmark correctly, we're looking at just in between the 4770K and the 3970K, looking at least the iTunes and the Handbrake benchmarks, or in the neighborhood of.
The 4960X is a 6-core 12-thread processor, right. But it is based on Ivy Bridge, while mm-hmm. the 4770K is based on Haswell. So it's interesting to look at something like iTunes, where it's kind of more of a single-threaded application, and the much, much lower price, at least in theory, Haswell part is faster than what you get with this apparent upcoming Ivy Bridge E. But when you get into a multi-threaded application like Handbrake, you do see the advantage of those 6-core processors as the 3930, 3970, and 4960 all beat the 4770K.
Yeah, not a huge advantage.
No, let's see. 113 seconds to 96 seconds is your advantage over Haswell. So you're talking about 14, 15%. I guess there. You're still right. It's not a huge advantage, but it is something worth noting, I guess. It's when you get to that bleeding edge of performance, it's always more for that last mile, absolutely every time.
How fast do you want to go? How much do you want to pay? And what's going to be interesting, USB's 3's popularity, is it slowly killing mainstream Thunderbolt adoption? 9to5 Mac wrote this up along with a bunch of sites. What are we talking about? Acer told CNET that they are removing Thunderbolt from its Aspire S5 Ultrabook this year, which was, quote, one of the only Windows notebooks to ship with the technology. Basically to say that they're focusing on USB 3.0. First of all, there's not a lot of Windows, or I should say PC motherboards, Intel motherboards, AMD motherboards with Thunderbolt in them on the desktop. It's a very short list. Do you think the quote from Ziller at Intel is there are more than a dozen new fourth generation core processor based platforms already launched with Thunderbolt, including from Lenovo, Dell, Asus, and others, with more coming throughout 2013. Thunderbolt is targeted towards premium systems. It is not targeted to be on the mid range or value systems in the next couple of years. Meanwhile, Apple is putting Thunderbolt on everything. I mean, do you think Thunderbolt's dead? Do you think USB 3.0 is going to kill Thunderbolt before it gains steam?
The last comment there by Ziller claims that Thunderbolt is targeted towards premium systems. It's not targeted to be on mid-range or value systems for the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. That leads to believe that maybe Thunderbolt has more of an outlook than that. I definitely agree that it's a much, much, much slower uptake than I had originally expected and hoped with Thunderbolt. It seems that Intel is I don't know exactly what it costs for this technology for Intel to actually make the controllers and all that kind of stuff, but I'm guessing they're making pretty healthy margins on it, and they are more or less choosing to make it a premium part as opposed to having it as you know, as trying to get it as widespread as possible. And I think that's unfortunate, because I think Thunderbolt is awesome, and I think what it can do is pretty impressive. And despite the fact that you know, Acer says that USB 3 is less expensive, has comparable bandwidth, charging for devices, there's a lot of things USB 3 does not do daisy chaining, it does not do support for display connectivity directly over the connection. And there's the benefits of Thunderbolt go well beyond it's just it has higher bandwidth.
I mean, so it carries a monitor, you can daisy chain up to six devices. You know, it's I guess it's kind of funny. I'm a little frustrated that they've already released the second generation Thunderbolts, or at least announced the second generation Thunderbolt standard back at WWDC. Well, I mean,
it's not a new standard. It's just they've gone from 10 gigabits up to 20 gigabits, right? So now you have another option, but they're backwards and forwards compatible.
Yeah, it's just kind of frustrating when it's like within a year of the launch. Within a year of the effective launch of a new bus, that they're already like, hey, we've doubled it. And it's like, hey, we just started this.
Right.
That just may be me whining because I get frustrated when they start. I don't know. I thought that was a little odd that they would release the bandwidth increase within a year. Yes, it's forward compatible. Yes, it's backwards compatible. No, there isn't a penalty on mixing these devices on the same daisy chain. But that is right. There is no penalty mixing the devices.
I don't know. I think you have to have the right controller at the board level to support any 20 gigabit across the way. So
yeah, you're probably not going to put a. You're not going to chain a 20 gigabyte device through a 10 gigabyte device to your 20 gigabyte computer. So let me retract and back away slowly from that statement. But I don't know. I hate specs evolving that quickly. Is that just anti-awesome of me?
I mean, no, I get it, and it adds confusion to the market for sure. But I don't know. It doesn't surprise me that USB 3 has the lead here and has the mindshare lead. It's kind of what I expected. And on one hand, I've kind of hoped it would be that way because it is a lower cost option. But Thunderbolt, just like the things you can do with Thunderbolt, like potentially, I hope continue to happen. And in order for that to happen, you need to have adoption and people demanding those types of devices. The whole PCI Express bus extension capability that Thunderbolt has is really what I think the killer feature will be. The idea to have external components functioning at the speed of PCI Express is really killer.
Speaking of killer or killed or dead or dying, Microsoft Surface RT, one of the great ass kickings of recent hardware launches. So Microsoft Q4 2013 earnings, like $19.9 billion in revenue, $4.97 billion in income, $900 million charge related to Surface RT inventory, quote, adjustment, unquote. Now, we've mentioned that Surface RT prices were dropping considerably, but oh my goodness. Did this turn out to be a wrong turn for Microsoft? Obviously, Microsoft dealing with a lot in the last 2 weeks, a complete major massive reorganization with a lot of a 2,700, you know, word email from Ballmer introducing it to the Microsoft community, who, of course, immediately sent it out to the world at large. But wow, that's a pretty epic fail. That's an even bigger epic fail than the Google TV fail at Logitech that nearly took Logitech out a couple of years ago. Obviously, Microsoft has a lot more revenue to absorb pain like this, but ow.
Yeah, $900 million. I wish somebody smarter than me should probably be able to do the math of how many Surface RTs that means are sitting in a warehouse someplace. Right?
A lot.
Like somebody could figure that out. If you take the hundreds, how big is the discount that they just gave? And I don't know exactly what it would be, but I think it would be interesting to see how many Surface RTs there are sitting around someplace.
I'm kind of curious how many, it's funny that Ouya launched recently. It shipped actually in Best Buy, and I want to say on Amazon, before all of the Kickstarter subscribers got their Ouyas in their hands. I thought it was interesting because the big thing I've heard from some of my more serious gaming friends and game reviewers is that, like, they like the idea, kind of. The shipping version solves almost all of the problems they have with the beta version or the early developer seeds of the Ouya, but there aren't a lot of exclusive titles for the Ouya, and that the majority of Android games are designed to be played with a phone, not with a remote. So Ouya, right, apparently next month is going to solve their exclusive titles problem by doing a Kickstarter, a $1 million Kickstarter matching campaign to encourage exclusive titles, reports Eric Johnson at All Things D. The developer aimed, quote, free the games fund, unquote, will dole out $1 million to eligible Ouya game projects that launch on Kickstarter between August 9, 2013 and August 10, 2014. The projects can ask for whatever amount they want, but if they meet their Kickstarter goals and raise at least $50,000, Ouya is pledging to match every dollar raised beyond that amount up to $250,000. And the condition is that the games are exclusive to Ouya for at least 6 months after their launch. Yeah. I mean, do you think Ouya is desperately trying to gain traction before the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4 arrive later this year? I mean, and it's funny because it's a $100 box. It's a very inexpensive box. It's really in a radically different price category.
Yeah, that's my thinking, is that I hope that's not what they're trying to do, because that's totally not the market that they're going after. I mean, this is, I consider the Ouya to be like, well, maybe it's going up against something like NVIDIA Shield, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's directly going up against it, and then it's an Android gaming, dedicated gaming platform. Right. And they need to, I think what happened is there was a ton of excitement for Ouya during the Kickstarter. There was this long delay. The first thing people heard about Ouya after this delay was that, well, it didn't turn out as great as we thought. The games aren't, the controller's bad and blah, blah, blah. And now they're trying to figure out ways to save the console and continue to make it a success that everyone thought it might be, right, after the just nuts Kickstarter release there. And I think this software application or this software program they're running sounds like a really interesting way to do it. And they're throwing their money behind it as well, which is important.
We will find out soon. It's kind of amazing that they actually have that much money to throw around even after their epic Kickstarter launch. Well, we're talking Android Central, says they have pictures of the new Nexus 7, Snapdragon S4 Pro, 4 gigabytes of DDR3 RAM. Nothing is set in stone, they say. They don't really know if these are legitimate pictures, but we have what may be the next 7-inch tablet direct from the heart of Google. So that's it's interesting because Nexus 7 has been sold out for a while, and it should be exciting to see this showing up, but a little early yet to know if that actually is the final Nexus 7. SSDs continuing to get cheaper, a really, really awesome graphic posted by Alan over at PCPro.com. The 840 Evo lineup, the new 1X nanometer TLC TurboWrite cache-equipped SSD line. Without further delay, here is the suggesting pricing for the Samsung 840 Evo. 120 gigabytes basic, $109.99. The desktop kit, $124.99. Going up to the epic and awesomeness of a 1 terabyte drive for $649.99. And I'm assuming that's MSRP. And I want to see how fast that 1 terabyte drive dripes. That's a new one. my week for creating new words, roughed instead of cruft, in terms of operating system decay. And 1 terabyte ripe. In any case, are you excited? I mean, SSDs are starting to really drop in price.
Yeah, you know what? I love to see not just like price drops, but planned price drops by manufacturers, right? Mm-hmm. So this to me is even more important because Samsung is showing a slide to a bunch of media and saying, hey, our 500 gig is going to be $369. It doesn't mean it's going to be retail for $499 and eventually you're going to be able to find it on sale for $369. That means we should expect to see it at this price when it first launches. And that upfront kind of knowledge sets a lot of expectations that I think are really good and right. kind of interesting. We didn't talk about the 840 Evo really at all today. I'll just mention it. Alan is over in Korea meeting with Samsung now about this device, among a couple of others. And what's interesting about the 840 Evo is that it upgrades the 840 class. Not the 840 Pro necessarily, but the 840 in some dramatic ways. It's using like 1x nanometer class NAND flash. So instead of 20 nanometer, I think this is going to be 14 nanometer flash. The new controller is 33% faster than the previous generation controller. It's now running at 400 megahertz instead of 300 megahertz. It has double the DRAM on board, 1 gig of system memory on the SSD. Over 512 of the previous one, and it has just some updated signal processing as well. And you know, that's, he goes into some more stuff here about how they're it's like a variation of the TLC memory that the non-pro version of the 840 was using, and there is a combination of that with some actual SLC flash in it too. So the new 840 Evo sounds pretty interesting, that they're doing some more things to bridge the gap between what MLC can do and what SLC can do, but the huge price delta there makes SLC still kind of prohibitively expensive. So obviously, as we saw the pricing we just talked about, they're doing their They're not just doing their best. I think they're doing a really good job of lowering prices, adding longevity to it in a way that's necessary as you lower when you use smaller and smaller NAND flash, like the lifespan of it gets less as well.
Right.
So you have to do other things technologically to, you know, ratchet it back up as close as you can to the previous generation. So it's kind of interesting to see what they are doing here with 840 Evo.
Yeah, it was interesting. Well, we're talking about reduced life cycles. Micron apparently is now sampling 16 nanometer NAND flash drives using the smaller chips expected in 2014. Tim Berry wrote this up for PC Per while Alan is off overseas. But it's funny, like 16 nanometer NAND flash, not really going to be a performance boost. It's basically going to be an aerial density boost. You know, quote, a pure shrink of 20 nanometers, which is in turn a shrink of 25 nanometer flash, 6 terabytes of storage out of a single 300 millimeter wafer. That's 128 gigabytes and as few as 8 chips. That is probably, if the yields are good, going to deliver a significant reduction in price, or at least there's potential for it. Alan noted to Tim that the new 16 nanometer flash is a reduction in the number of supported PE cycles. Expected to have less than 1,000 PE cycles. So that's like 25 nanometers running at 3,000, 20 nanometer flash around 1,000. So the program erase cycle number is going to go down. But even with the reduced number of program erase cycles expected out of 16 nanometer flash, it still should outlast in consumer use a traditional rotating media hard drive, which should last several hundred thousand hours. So don't panic yet. Or just do what we mentioned earlier in the show, put a lot of RAM in your system.
That will help.
Good for Micron. You got hands-on. We saw it. It was all over CES. It was kind of the bell of the ball at CES, at least if you made video, because it was so fun to play on a gigantic tabletop computer. You got hands-on with the Idea Center Horizon Table PC. Gimmick, fun, joy, irritated?
You know, I kind of have to say at this point that it's kind of gimmick to me. Which is really sad because I had some high expectations for it and high hopes for it. It's still it's so, for people who don't know, it's an all-in-one PC that is a touchscreen, 27-inch, 1080p touchscreen, 10-point touchscreen, but it folds flat to the table. And the intent is that they call it a multi-user PC, not just a multi-touch PC. So the idea would be that, you know, you can have multiple people sit around this at a table and use it. The videos from CES were like, oh, hey, look, as I'm doing in the video here, look, I'm sharing photos, right? I can right. zoom in and out. I can toss them to the side so somebody else could sit there and look at them and cycle through a bunch of pictures that way. You can do it with video. You can do it with music. The issue is it's just not,
There's not a lot of applications designed for multi-touch gaming while laid flat out on a table.
Yeah, that especially. I mean, even so, this special interface, the Lenovo built it, right? This is Aura. This is something that they built for this specifically. It makes a cool demo, but it doesn't like integrate with Facebook or, you know, your Dropbox account necessarily. It doesn't have any of these integrations with modern social networking or applications that I think would actually make it useful, right? So if I could sit there and have it directly access my Facebook account and look through pictures this way, maybe that's more interesting. It's more interesting to a lot more users, I guess. Just having it say, you basically do with it as you would the most basic applications. You point it to a folder on your desktop, and that's where it sources all of your media from. And it's just not as interesting to me. And then the gaming side of it is neat, but the only game that I've actually thought was any good was Monopoly, that was included in it by default. Monopoly was actually a lot of fun, but
you have the big sort of plastic mock die, and there's a couple of hockey, like air hockey paddles that come with the computer.
Those just don't work very well. They're very laggy. Those weren't cool. Like Monopoly is not cool because of that big die that has the wireless USB sensor in it. You know, rolling the die as we just did in the video is actually way more fun and much quicker because you actually had two of those on the screen. So yeah, just like that.
They caught the spirit of Monopoly, and the accessories are more like, oh dear.
Yeah, but then they had other games on there, like they had a poker game, and they had a air hockey and stuff like that. And it was just not, they just weren't any good. Right. And if there were other, if software developers were willing to build like, hey, why isn't there a Scrabble game for this? Why isn't there a Risk game for this? Why isn't there a Stratego for this? Right. This is a perfect platform for board game replacement type thing.
That was something. It was fun to play with at CES, but part of me thought like, okay, it's got a 7,000 milliamp hour battery. It's going to run on your table. You know, I can just pull a $12 Scrabble board out of the cabinet and use that instead. You know, it's neat. I think it's, you know, I like the Idea Center desktops, I think a little bit more than the Horizon Table PC, but I thought it was worth talking about this week.
It's definitely an interesting device. It's like if there were, not just if there were a half dozen other pieces of software that made it cool, but if I had seen like support since it's been released, like, we've got, this is going to come out in June. This is going to come out in July. We've got these two titles in August. This is our roadmap. There's nothing like that. It was more, here is this one time use interface with these one-time use games. They have a Lenovo app store, but I went to it and there's like nothing that really stands out there. And it's like, do I really need another app store anyway?
ThinkPads are still awesome.
I wonder, does Microsoft have nothing like, none of their user interface is meant for tabletop stuff, right? Like in Windows 8 or 8.1. Like that was Microsoft Surface a long time ago, but nothing... Yeah. Really kind
this
of
Surface was this. Yeah, it's kind of funny. I think of, you know, I think Surface was an experiment. I think a lot of the multi-touch inside of Surface got integrated into 8.1, but for the screen use. You know, it's funny. It's like ThinkPads are still amazing. I really like the Idea Center all-in-one PCs that Lenovo are selling. You know, I kind of feel like a lot of the horizon was to get attention at CES, which it did. I was kind of afraid that if you had it for more than a few days, it might start to feel, it might start to run out of steam. No gaming pun intended, but it's frustrating, right? Because they probably spent a lot of their money getting that Monopoly game either developed or adapted to work with that tabletop. And that's just, you know, if you don't have a large installed user base, you don't get a lot of interest in that, which is kind of bringing us back to Ouya dropping $1 million to get more exclusive titles.
Right.
Gee whiz. Email us, Twitch, TWICH at twit.tv is the email address. We got an email from Matthew looking for a, quote, active cooled router. And suddenly I want liquid cooling in my router. We went nuts talking about cooling this week because somebody actually asked us if they should use Nitro G, which we finally realized with nitrogen, liquid nitrogen cooling versus liquid cooling on their PC. And we're kind of like, just get a fan, dude. Just get a fan. Matthew says, I'm having a problem with my wireless router. It keeps dropping connection and crashing. I've had a look and I noticed it's running very hot. Unfortunately, I'm unable to move the router to a cooler location. Can you suggest a router that uses active cooling? I need a router that has 5 gigabit ports on it, not including the WAN port, standard Wi-Fi specs. 802.11ac would be nice, but not essential as I don't have any device that supports this yet. I have been told that the new Apple AirPort Extreme is very good and has active cooling, but I can't see any mention of this in their website. Any help you can give will be much appreciated. I don't know if I'd say the new Apple AirPort has active cooling.
I don't think it does.
It has a big giant cooling tower in the middle of it, which you might mistake for active cooling. But so the Apple AirPort Extreme, which is essentially Apple's new wireless router, has a big hollow center, right? Their next generation desktop is going to do the same thing, where they essentially have a whole bunch of air wrapped by the panels, by the boards. I'm trying to think. I thought there was a picture of the inside of that. Do you ever notice how you can never find a picture on Apple's website when you need it?
Well, I was looking at the iFixit teardown, actually.
Even better.
Yeah, and I think there might be a fan in it. I'm looking at this as well. This is the one with the hard. This is the what's with the hard drive? It's not the AirPort. It's the
AirPort Extreme.
No, it has the hard drive in it. So it's the no. There's a fan in this. Yeah, the time capsule. Okay. So the time capsule has a fan in it.
Okay.
It's a very small fan. So technically, I guess that is active cooled. So
let's see, AirPort Extreme.
Well, yeah, just look up AirPort Extreme teardown, and the last set of photos on it is the fan side there. It does mention the fan. So it only has 3 Ethernet ports, doesn't have it only has 3 gigabit ports plus WAN. Right. It doesn't have 5 that he needs. You know, I'm going to be honest. I don't know of really any other routers that are actively cooled, or if they are, they're very, very quiet, and I don't notice it.
I mean, the problem with active cooling, right? We've basically stuffed all of our media equipment, and I'm in the process of moving our media server, our main backup server, into the basement. But between the server and the power amp for my home theater, we would easily have like 85, 90 degree temperatures inside this closet. Mm. The problem is when you're cooling something, it gets enormously difficult to cool it below room temperature.
correct.
You know, if you're running a fan on it. Now, yeah, there it is. Fans away. A DC brushless fan from Delta Electronics is inside of that. So that would move air inside of the router. The problem is it wouldn't necessarily, unless the router was more comfortable in your super hot environment, it's not necessarily going to help the router that much. That said, I've seen people have issues with routers or computers and drill holes in the top of the case. You know, basically crack the case, drill holes in the case, or basically replace the top of a case with mesh because then the heat would rise out of it. Sounds stupid. Right. Certainly not pretty. But it can be aesthetically pleasing if you do a good job. But generally speaking, you know, most people don't want to tear apart their electronics to drill holes in it and reassemble it. But if you're having that much issues, you know, the reason these super cool next generation PC cases are putting the power supplies at the top is because a lot of the heat is coming from the power supply. Unless you found out differently on the interview this week, but I've never really seen an actively cooled router. The best thing you can do is get some kind of air supply into that room. I guess you could sort of, you know, you could put a water block on top of it and run cooling lines to some other part of the house where the radiator and fan for the water block was. But that's kind of nuts for a wireless router.
I would highly recommend trying to do something on your own and see if it really is a temperature issue. Even if it's just getting a small fan and putting it under or, you know, to the side or on top of the current one you have to try to push cooler air through it. Mm-hmm. And if it's something that, if you're going to buy a replacement and you're not going to sell the one you have, it's totally worth taking it apart and drilling a hole in it and seeing if you can fix it that way. And if you Google around for router fan mods, you're going to find people that have done just that. They have added fans to their routers specifically for that purpose, right? So you look at like the Linksys WRT54G. There's pictures of them all over the place with fans on top sucking the hot air out of them. So something you can absolutely do. And if you have a common router, you can go in and find ones where you can probably even solder or connect or splice into another power cable to keep that fan running without having to like add another power brick or power plug to your wall.
That picture of the Linksys is so awesome. I will also say that there are some fantastic inexpensive routers that don't run very hot at all. And you might also consider upgrading to one of them, but
saying there's a picture here I saw of one that has like a big thermal right heat sink on it. No fan. So it's silent, but it has a giant thermal right, like CPU heat sink coming at the top of it. That's pretty impressive.
That's part of what's so funny is like the heat isn't a problem so much as the chips getting too hot. The chips getting too hot is where everything starts to go sideways. Well, I just want to say it so that we said it, but the whole point of drilling holes in the case or adding a fan on the case or putting a fan next to the case or just dumping the case entirely is to suck more air over the chips.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm stating the obvious just so it's stated so we don't get emails saying that. What in the world is that? Put that back up, Bert.
That's pretty good. Pretty
That's good. Seriously awesome. I think that gets the aesthetic award for best DIY router fan.
I think so.
That's pretty.
Yeah, see, I mean, the people are getting creative with this stuff. It's kind of interesting. So it may if you just need kind of like a weekend project, open it up, see what you need to go get at Home Depot, and give it a shot. Yeah, what's it gonna, if you're going to buy another router anyway, it's not going to cost you anything extra. Maybe nothing you'll fix it and be like really impressed with yourself.
Right? And nothing says party like a fresh hole saw from Home Depot or Lowe's. Ooh.
That one's pretty at least, yeah.
I don't know. It's also amazing what you can do just hanging a motherboard or a PCB on a wall in terms of reducing the amount of heating. As long as you don't put it too close to the wall. Airflow is king.
Yep.
With that bright and cheerful thought, airflow being king, 4K monitors being awesome and entirely too expensive right now if you want to run at 60 hertz, that's it for Twits this week. What's coming up on PC Per, man? Are you excited?
So I'm going to have a full article on this Asus PQ321 display, hopefully maybe Friday, maybe Monday, depends on how much of that I can get done. We did post a review just today of the MSI GT60 laptop, which is actually really good. It's a Haswell powered laptop gaming machine with a GeForce GTX 780M graphics chip in there, so the fastest mobile graphics that you can buy as well. And then the most important thing that we're doing is we have QuakeCon coming up, which means it is time for the fifth annual PC Perspective Hardware Workshop, which will be held on Saturday of QuakeCon, so August 3rd at 12:30 p.m. At the main stage. And we'll have our workshop there. We had between 1,700 and 1,800 people there last year. We've already started getting in all the prizes and swag that we're going to throw out to the audience, raffle out to the audience. We've got video cards and motherboards and monitors and cases and all kinds of good stuff that we're going to give out again this year. And it's possible that we may actually try to record a podcast live with if anybody wants to come in and watch it on Wednesday night. So we might do that as well, and then hang out with anybody who's fans of PC Perspective or This Week in Computer Hardware. We can go over to the hotel bar and hang out for a little bit and see people. So that's the next big thing on my list is organization for that entire event, getting signage and posters and T-shirts and prizes and booking travel and all that other kind of good stuff. So
it's a long trip to QuakeCon for Ryan. If you see him, buy him a drink. Or
it's a 15-hour drive through the middle of the night to QuakeCon for Ryan, so
it's worth it. It's exciting.
It's fun.
We are building our first 3D printer on Taxilla. We got the PrinterBot Simple in. It's funny. They're actually from a small town not too far from Sacramento, and it's a $300 3D printer, which I will actually be finishing assembling after we get done with the podcast today. So I'm excited.
I'm excited about that. Yeah, I'm really eager to see what I can do for $300. How big of an object did you say it could make?
You're going to want a bigger. Basically, okay. Well, it's a 100 millimeter cube of printing volume. So you can print like a 4-inch cube.
Okay.
So a little bit bigger than a baseball, smaller than a softball, if I remember the size of a softball correctly.
All right. I'm good for that.
But it's crazy. It's like, 5.25 pounds. It runs off 12 volts. It's really neat because they're essentially, it's laser cut wood, but super tight assembly, decent bearings. And they did a couple tweaks to the print head because basically all the good stuff happens in the print head, I am told by the 3D printing experts. But it's funny. I mean, you kind of open the bags, look at this pile of parts. You're kind of like, okay, this is like the first time I opened up a carburetor. There's a lot of small parts inside of this thing. But it's going together. We've got it about 2/3 done in a couple hours. And, I am super excited to print my first object later this evening, which hopefully will look like the object it's supposed to off of the Thingiverse website. Well, you know what I mean? It's like, I can remember the early days of inkjet printing, and I'm hoping I'm not as heartbroken the first time I print something out with this as I was the first time I printed something out on an inexpensive inkjet printer. I'm just saying. I was like, wow, that's almost like a color picture, except not. In any case, this is Twitch. And I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ranchfire.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.